back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are always online at npr.org. What we like to do here is we like to keep our finger on the pulse of the internet. But in doing so, we cheat. We don't kind of go out there and figure out ourselves. We haven't invented an algorithm. That takes time to invent an algorithm. We just go on all these other sites and see what people are emailing to each other. But we at least have branded this exercise as the most. So our first moster will be Trisha from the control room.
Yeah,
what
I most
do you have for us today?
I want to get this one out of the way because it's a real downer.
Okay.
I apologize, but this one is everywhere,
yeah.
So we really got to do it. It's the most emailed and one of the most viewed right now at MSNBC.com among other places. The headline is Man Admits 24-Year Abuse of Daughter in Cellar. This happened in Austria. A 73-year-old Austrian man has confessed to imprisoning his daughter, who's now 42, for 24 years in a cellar. And it gets worse. He fathered 7 children with her. So he kept her underground. Nobody knew she was there. Apparently, she had been reported missing as a runaway, but the whole time she was in the basement. I think I'm going to end it there. It's a gruesome story.
Yeah, go find it online if you want to read the details.
The kids are in custody and in therapy with authorities. Dan, bring us back. Bring us back to the world of
I'll see what I can do. We have the most email here from Newsday, the paper of record out on Long Island. Headline, two men in Oyster Bay to apply for marriage license. And
wait a minute. You can't do that in Oyster Bay.
That's right. Nor anywhere in New York State can two gay people apply for a marriage. Well, they can apply, but they're not going to get it.
That's it.
But they're trying to make a statement, and they're going to do this today in Oyster Bay. They're going to go to the town clerk's office at 3:30 this afternoon with $40 and 2 forms of ID. And they're going to apply for a marriage license. Their names are Dan Panello and Lee Nisselsohn, age 58 and 50, respectively. They've been together for a long time. They want to exchange vows. Mr. Panello says, we're middle-aged people. We prefer not to do this, but we don't have a choice. He's a government professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. These two guys have been working on this for a while. They started a big letter-writing campaign. They've been trying to pressure various state reps in New York State to get it on the ballot, to get same-sex marriage on the ballot. It hasn't happened yet. They're calling this an act of civil disobedience. Town spokesman Jim Moriarty said only, quote, if and when this occurs, the request will be reviewed consistent with applicable state law.
And you said that was a most from Newsday.
Newsday.
I believe you said that. But
I
if you didn't, we wanted to clarify.
I just said it again.
All right. Jeannie, what do you have?
Well, it's most emailed on Yahoo. Apparently, Leonardo da Vinci designed the world's first known parachute 500 years ago.
That man can't stop him. He did so many things.
Oh, my goodness.
Helicopter too.
Apparently, there was an attempt in 2000 to put his specifications to use, but it wasn't a success all the way to landing exactly where you want to land until just now. A Swiss amateur parachutist named Olivier Vietti-Tepi called it a perfect jump. He landed at a Swiss military airport. And it looked sort of like a four-sided cone as opposed to that typical round shape.
It looks like a pyramid without a bottom.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, he didn't bother with the wooden frame that Da Vinci had in his original designs.
Uh-huh.
And he also was successful in a way that earlier attempts were not because he used modern fabrics. Apparently the guy who tried it in 2000, a Brit, used the fabrics that would have been available in medieval times, and he had to cut it loose before he got to the end because the fabric could have crushed him and killed him. And he used a backup parachute instead. So that one doesn't count.
He would have been crushed by the fabric? What kind of fabric was it?
Could have been crushed.
Chainmail.
Gotta wonder.
The old chainmail parachute never did quite work, did it?
It's good. I mean, it's good to study Da Vinci, maybe look at his drawings and sketching. To actually jump out of an airplane based on your love and faith in Da Vinci.
I wouldn't want to fly the Da Vinci helicopter.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. What do you think came first, the helicopter or the way to get out of the helicopter? What if he invented a parachute and there was, just jump off a mountain? What do you jump from?
Ahead of the game.
Ahead of himself, even.
Rachel?
Okay, mine is one of the most emailed on the NewYorkTimes.com. I love this story because it's about story problems, those elusive story problems you might have had in junior high and high school. I hate these friggin' things. I don't think I'm supposed to say friggin'.
In the math context, it's acceptable.
Listen, one train leaves station A at 6 p.m.
I'm not sure that second one canceled out the first one, by the way.
You know the story of the premise of the story problem. You got train A, you got train B. Look, Mike's trying to write them down because he's going to solve it.
One train leaves station A
at 6 p.m., traveling 40 miles per hour towards station B. A second train leaves station B at 7 p.m., traveling on parallel tracks at 50 miles per hour towards station A. The stations are 400 miles apart. When do the trains pass each other? You have 7 seconds.
Toledo.
No.
11:30 p.m. because I read the story.
Oh, you're such a cheater. So the whole thing is that these actually don't help you learn math as well as they were purported to. I know, right? They are, according to a new study that's going to be released. The results will appear in Friday's issue of the journal Science, so you know it's true. They say that these real-life details are distractions.
Totally.
And Dr. Kaminsky, who conducted the study, said the problem with the real-world examples was that they obscured the underlying math, and students are not able to transfer their knowledge to new problems. I knew it all along.
See, when I can't figure out a math problem, I like to blame the problem.
Good idea. Me too.
I like to just blame the conductor that the train was slow.
Right.
Yeah.
Dan, the man.
Do we have anything else? Are we mosted out?
Oh,
you guys tell me.
We were going to do Mr. Irrelevant on Google Trends, but I think we could let that go. It was number 5 this morning.
We hit that. We covered it. But, Dan, you did some research. Has a Mr. Irrelevant ever actually had relevance in the NFL?
Well, you actually, nice of you to try to give me the credit, Mike, but you found out that Jim Finn, former fullback for the New York Giants and the pride of Bergen Catholic, pride of Fairlawn, New Jersey, played for the New York Football Giants. He was number 20, no longer with the team. But I was at the Giants draft day party on Saturday, which was quite a good time.
Let's argue on the blog, draft good or bad, draft fun or non-fun, okay? Well,
of course it's fun. It's one tiny, I'll tell you in one sentence why it's great, is that it's one tiny oasis of football.
Get ready to fade the mic,
in the middle of a long, dry spell.
Get ready to fade the mic.
You and your oasis. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the most. You can find links to all these stories, except that last oasis comment on our website. Go to npr.org/Brian Park.
Next from one of the most frequently quoted people you rarely hear, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. But Scalia's got a book out calling Making Your Case, so he's talking. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg had a conversation with the justice. Here's some of her report.
Antonin Scalia is a man of many contradictions. An only child, he's the father of 9 children. Tough-minded and thick-skinned in public, in private, he suffers when attacked. Often confrontational on the bench and sarcastic, even acidic in dissent, in private, he's charming and funny. Scalia has made his biggest mark so far in those biting dissents. His pen is an unsparing skewer. He's mocked Chief Justice John Roberts, a fellow conservative, accusing him of, quote, faux judicial restraint. He said Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's view on abortion, quote, cannot be taken seriously. And just this month, he derided Justice John Paul Stevens' views on the death penalty, calling them, quote, the purest form of rule by judicial fiat, even though Stevens agreed with Scalia on the end result. So I asked Justice Scalia if using that kind of language in written opinions is wise, whether in fact it might not alienate potential allies on the court.
When it is wrong, it should be destroyed.
Destroyed?
I think all of the reasons it is wrong should be pointed out and pointed out forcefully. And I don't mind people doing that to my opinions. A good, hard-hitting dissent keeps you honest.
Scalia is famous as a so-called originalist and textualist, or as he puts it, my Constitution is not living, it is dead. It means what the framers intended back at the founding of the Republic. So if capital punishment was constitutional in 1791, it still is today.
Whatever they understood then is, in my view, the meaning of the Confrontation Clause now. And it's not up to me to say, well, it really shouldn't mean that anymore. It should mean something different. Once you get into that boat, you have no criterion. It's up to the individual preferences of 9 justices. And that's just not the way it ought to work.
So if you put people in stocks in the public square, which was a common practice then?
I would say that may be very stupid, but it's not unconstitutional if indeed it was a punishment that was at that time accepted. Now, you know, the more ridiculous you make the example, the less likely it is to occur. They used to notch ears too.
Contrary to public perceptions, Scalia and fellow conservative Clarence Thomas do not march in lockstep. Thomas is far less willing to abide by the court's past decisions, while Scalia says he does not believe in undoing most of what's become law until now.
I am a textualist. I am an originalist. I am not a nut.
His mantra is that states are free to do what they want about most of the controversial questions of the day. They can legalize abortion or not, legalize homosexual conduct or not, legalize assisted suicide or not. But when Oregon did, in fact, legalize assisted suicide, Scalia dissented on other grounds. He's accused his fellow justices of taking sides in the culture wars. His critics say that it is he who's taken sides by the tone of his dissents. For example, in the case where the court struck down a state law that made private homosexual conduct a crime.
I don't know why that's taking sides. The next step is for the court to say that same-sex marriage must be permitted. It's hard to distinguish the one from the other.
Hasn't happened in this court, though, has it?
Well, it happened in Canada, didn't it? It is a living constitutional principle, and Canada's a living constitution court.
Scalia is no stranger to criticism from all quarters. When he provided the fifth vote striking down a law making it a crime to burn the American flag, his own wife, Maureen, greeted him in the morning singing, "It's a grand old flag."
I got a lot of heat from that opinion, really. Serious, biting criticism from the quarter that I usually don't get criticism from, that is to say from the right rather than the left. And I just want to give credit to a wonderful gentleman who was President Bush I. He wrote a handwritten note, not to me, I think he would have thought that was improper, but he wrote it to Maureen, saying, "And I see your husband's been getting a lot of criticism for his flag-burning decision. You tell him not to worry about it. He did the right thing." Wasn't that a nice thing for the president to do? I mean, gee, he had a lot of other things to worry about. I'm eternally grateful for that. It was such a nice gesture.
With the addition of two new Bush appointees on the Supreme Court, Scalia's views are now on the verge of prevailing in most cases for the first time in his tenure.
In the big cases, I'm maybe not as much of a big loser as I used to be, if you want to keep score. But, you know, winning, losing, isn't it? That's never been my objective. And it's my hope that in the fullness of time, the majority of the court will come to see things, at least for the future.
That was NPR's Nina Totenberg talking with Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. You can hear the entire conversation at our website, npr.org/BryantPark.